Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today, on The Brian Lehrer Show, a call in for the 3rd of July. With a Pew poll finding millennials much less patriotic than baby boomers, how is your patriotism different from your parents or your kids? Also today, ISIS wants a caliphate in Iraq and Syria. So what's a caliphate anyway? When and where were there actual caliphates in human history, and what kinds of models are they for today? Caliphate realities, caliphate myths on our program today, and who are you going to root for in the World Cup now that the United States has been eliminated? I'm going with Costa Rica, another lost cause, but I don't care. How about you? But first, is New York real estate the new Swiss bank account, and is international money laundering pushing up housing costs for the rest of us? That's the shadowy world that Andrew Rice mucks around in a long new investigative piece in New York Magazine. Let's see what he dug up. Andrew Rice, welcome to WNYC today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
This is about wealthy Russians, Chinese, Italians, Nigerians, Israelis, Arabs, anyone from anywhere really looking for some place to hide their money. So first, why do you use the word hide? Is New York real estate for them some kind of tax dodge?
Well, I mean, there's a variety of motivations, and I think if you read the full story, it explores them in maybe a little more depth and nuance than just merely that the headline. But I think that, you know,
I read the whole story, by the way, and I'll tell our listeners it's about as long as War and Peace, but mostly worth it. So go ahead.
Okay, great. I think that the thing that attracts foreign investors, I mean, they come to New York for the same reason that everybody else comes to New York and invests money in New York real estate. I mean, they see it as a stable investment. They see it as somewhere where they can get a return. But the other attraction is, frankly, that it is very opaque, and you can create structures, corporate structures, that allow you to mask your ownership of property quite easily here in the United States, and that has a great deal of attractiveness.
Like LLCs, for example,
reasons.
Right? What they call LLCs.
Yes, limited liability corporations.
Which is the same thing, by the way, that can hide your campaign contributions to candidates for office in New York State, something that the campaign finance reform that Governor Cuomo failed to get through in New York State would have changed. But that's an aside.
Well, I mean, LLCs have plenty of legitimate business reasons. I mean, they're sort of the de facto kind of corporate structure for, you know, any kind of private investment. I've found in my experience in covering real estate, but I've been doing this for more than a decade, and it's always been a little strange to me that, you know, there's really no way to get behind that corporate veil of who owns an LLC. So in this story, I attempted to kind of get a little bit behind that, and you know what I discovered was, you know, there's a large proportion of investors, foreign investors, who are investing for, you know, legitimate investment purposes, tax advantages, and so on. And, you know, there's a significant minority of people, it seems, who are using it for laundering purposes.
And you suggest that some of this money is ill-gotten from foreign financial and corruption scandals, and that New York real estate is a good washing machine for money laundering. And it turns out, in a University of Utah study that you cite, that it's actually easier to set up an untraceable shell company in the United States than in any other country on earth except Kenya. How does that work?
Well, I mean, I was quite surprised to learn this, but an international team of academics led by a woman named Shima Baradaran at the University of Utah created this study where they impersonated a variety of characters. For instance, one of them was the Lebanese representative of an Islamic charity based in Saudi Arabia, and another one was an Uzbek political fixer who claimed to have connections to the ruling regime in Uzbekistan. And they sent out these emails to these companies that provide what are called incorporation services, where for $1,000 or so, they'll set up an LLC for you. And she said that they tried to make it as shady as possible, was her quote. And basically, they found that in the United States, that especially in states like Delaware and Nevada that are very business friendly, they found people more than willing to do it. In fact, suggesting, for instance, political corruption, most surprisingly, actually increased the amount of kind of willingness that these incorporation service providers were willing to extend.
Take that, Switzerland and Cayman Islands. We're number one or number two behind Kenya. Your article opens...
Poor Kenya.
Poor Kenya, that's right. How'd they do in the World Cup? Never mind. let's take an example. Your article opens with the story of an Italian who came to town here with $1 million to spend. Want to use her as an example? What's her story?
Well, so her story was that she had about a $1.2 million budget. She's Italian. Her husband's Italian, and you know, she asked for anonymity, so I've got to be a little careful about the identifying details. But she said that her husband is in the oil business in Nigeria, and was visiting, trying to invest some money here. And, you know, when I asked her about why she wanted anonymity, she sort of said, well, you know, investing in Italy is very problematic right now. And part of the reason why it's problematic, as her broker, you know, explained, was that, you know, there are tax issues. Italy has a tax on overseas assets. And you know, the straw, I don't want to get too deeply into our off-the-record conversations, but let's just say that I don't think necessarily that the Italian tax collectors are going to be hearing about this.
And we'll get into how that affects the rest of us in a minute with respect to housing prices in New York. But the apartment in that anecdote is on the 27th floor of 20 Pine, a condo in the Wall Street area. And you remind us that building was once an emblematic disaster of the financial crisis of 2008. What's the history of 20 Pine?
Well, 20 Pine was formerly an office building. It was purchased by a couple of developers, one of whom was a guy named Lev Leviev, who is a sort of a Uzbekistan-born, Israeli-based diamond magnate who got into developing New York property prior to the real estate crash, and they hired a guy named Michael Chavot, who's a very well known figure in New York real estate circles, to market the building, kind of like as a the idea was it was like for really flashy bankers, you know, in the financial district, and they were going to get all these iBankers to go and buy their $1 million condos and so on. They had a 24-hour sales office just so, like, you know, on their way back from the meatpacking district, they could come and check out a $1 million condo. What ended up happening was that they got completely caught out by the crash in 2008. And what after that happened, I mean, there were real desperation sales at 20 Pine, and the way that the developers kind of got themselves out of the mess was that all these foreign investors came in and sometimes buying units up in bulk, usually at really cut rate prices, you know, well under their original asking price, sometimes even half off. You heard about these deals. And so it really became, you know, this center for foreign real estate investment. And it's not just this building. There are many of the buildings that were kind of built that were kind of like the bubble buildings that were built at the sort of the height of the bubble. When you wonder sort of like, well, whatever happened to those buildings and how did those developers keep from going bankrupt? And the cases where they didn't go bankrupt, oftentimes it was that you know, the foreign buyers came along,
right,
and sort of bailed them out.
So they kind of helped keep the market afloat and were in a certain kind of way good guys at that time. Now, in housing terms, they're bad guys. This happened before in New York, right? This is, in a way, nothing new. 1980s, there was a little bit of a real estate crash, and it was a lot of Japanese money at that time flowing in and buying what they saw as bargain prices for New York real estate. And then when that market started to turn upward again, I think New Yorkers were having the same conversation about the Japanese. Oh, the Japanese, the big bad Japanese are swooping in and buying all our real estate and pushing up our housing costs. Now it's rich people from everywhere.
I think that's true, but I guess the difference is between this kind of boom and prior ones is that, first of all, it's not just one country, that is dominating the investment. I mean, this is a really broad based kind of trend. And second of all, in the Japanese case, I mean, I was not covering real estate in the 1980s, but my understanding of it was that a lot of it was really concentrated at the very high end, you know, sort of trophy purchases that the Japanese buyers would often, you know, come in and sort of buy, you know, if I recall correctly, I think maybe they bought Rockefeller Center, you know, but definitely like large trophy buildings were the sort of gravitational pull on Japanese investors. This is much different in the sense that it's much more broad-based. I mean, you have people coming in. You have Chinese buyers coming in at the million-dollar price point at places like 400 Fifth Avenue or you know, these buildings in the financial district that we were talking about. And then you have the super wealthy folks at the very top end who are driving all this development around Central Park, around 57th Street. The building 157 is the most prominent example, but there's quite a number of these buildings going up now where properties top out the prices at, you know, $90 million, $100 million.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yes.
And, of course, then it gets bound up in the shadows cast on Central Park with these new tall buildings like 157 and the one on Park Avenue, and the fact that these are foreign moguls who aren't even going to live there and we're sacrificing sunlight in Central Park for that, not even for affordable housing for New Yorkers, what's going on here. So that all gets into the conversation, too, as we talk with Andrew Rice from New York Magazine on the long investigative piece in the new issue that basically asks, is New York real estate the new Swiss bank account? And listeners, I wonder if you're aware of this phenomenon touching you. Any listeners right now who missed out on buying a property because there was an all-cash buyer standing behind you willing to outbid you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Give us a call or with anything you want to say or ask about this topic for Andrew Rice, editor at New York Magazine, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And how does this trickle down? How does this affect the rest of the Manhattan real estate market, the rest of the New York City area real estate market, as far as you could tell? Or is it just the people who are buying $88 million condos?
Well, I think it has a real effect. I mean, it is difficult to quantify because of the fact that the foreign buyers are buying under these oftentimes opaque corporate structures that make it difficult to trace. You just see a name like, you know, sometimes they have like quite sort of amusing names like Escape from New York LLC. It was one of the ones at 157. So you see that, and there's really no way. There's just a lawyer's contact information. There's no way to sort of figure out where this money is coming from. But our estimates, based on sort of both market research, anecdotal evidence, and a lot of really close analysis of deeds in large-scale Manhattan condo developments, we came up with a figure, it's a rough figure, of around 30% of the sales are being driven in large Manhattan condo developments are being driven by foreign investors. Now, how does that affect? First of all, I mean, in an obvious way, it makes it much more difficult to buy a new Manhattan condo. But second of all, I mean, the fact that there's less of that inventory for regular New Yorkers means that people are being increasingly pushed into other neighborhoods. You know, as I said, you know, a lot of affluent or wealthy New Yorkers are now moving into Brooklyn. But in fact, wealthy investors are also moving into Brooklyn. I mean, I heard about investors who are buying up, you know, buildings in Crown Heights and basically kicking out the rent stabilized people who are there if they could and renovating and then turning them into sort of, you know, more luxury priced residential rentals. You know, there's an Australian private equity fund that's done something kind of similar in Bushwick. So, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's constricted supply. The inventory in New York is still at record lows since 2008. There's really just, if you've been out looking for a condominium or a co-op or a house in New York City, you know that there's just like there's nothing on the market. You go to an open house and it's sort of like you know, it's like a train station in Calcutta or something like that.
It's,
you know, trying to sort of check out the bathroom and so I think that, you know, it's definitely having a big trickle down effect. It's not the only thing that's driving it. Part of it has to do with the fact that there isn't a lot of development being built right now by historical standards, but it's definitely having an effect on the marketplace.
Here, I think, is a caller with a story of this extending into Brooklyn. Lennox in Queens.
Hi. Yes, my name is Lennox, and I just wanted to piggyback on what your guest was saying, because this was May of last year. My wife and I, we were attempting to purchase a brownstone in Brooklyn. And, you know, we got down there, saw several properties, and we put our bids in, and only to find out that we got outbid several times by cash buyers. And one of the realtors even commented that there were hedge fund managers who were buying these properties cash for hedge funds and just swallowing these properties up hook, line, and sinker, and just moving everyone else out of the market. So, yes, there is quite a cash buyer's market for real estate in New York, even in Brooklyn.
Lennox, thank you very much. Well, another testimonial, Andrew, to the detriment of one immigrant living in Queens who wanted to buy a Brooklyn brownstone.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say from my own experience, this wasn't a motivating factor in doing the story, but it came into play. I mean, you know, my wife and I were looking at maybe buying a home a year or so ago, and you know, we put in a bid and on a place, and you know, we're kind of like your typical kind of scrape together all your you know, every single cent that you have so you can get 20%. And
really,
and
they don't pay you seven figures at New York Magazine?
Well, everyone should subscribe who's listening right now, and perhaps I'll be able to make an all cash bid next time. But the moral of the story was, you know, we got beat out by, you know, $80,000 by someone who was paying all cash, and it is, you know, I do think the one thing that this story has tapped into is that there is a sort of like frustration, not just among the affordable housing debate, and you know, not just among people who are at the lowest socioeconomic rungs, but really people who are quite affluent by any normal standard feel as if it's just impossible to compete with those cash buyers in New York.
Ellen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. I was very interested in this topic, but I'm curious if how many of these developments did you look at whether we have given away all the tax proceeds that we might get from the development, from the buyers through 421A tax abatements to the developers, so that not only are they coming in and scooping up property, but that we're not actually getting any tax benefit from it?
Or I guess another way to frame that question is they're hiding their money from the tax collectors in the countries they come from, and we're giving the developers tax subsidies to build and then sell to them. Does that equation reflect reality, Andrew?
Well, it certainly, I mean, especially new construction. I mean, buildings that especially that went into the ground prior to the reform of the 421A law in around 2007 or 2008, if I recall correctly, were able to get these quite enormous, oftentimes tax abatements that were time limited. But if you buy in, say, 157, and their situation was a little bit more controversial, they involved a little sleight of hand in Albany to get the 421A abatement for 157. But the upshot of it is that the people who are buying these at the most expensive address in Manhattan right now are getting a 94% tax abatement on these condos for the first 10 years or so that they own them.
Why? Under what public purpose or old law that once had a public purpose, or why?
Well, the 421A program is basically it's to incentivize new construction, new development. Obviously, there's a large construction industry in New York City that needs jobs, and so that tax abatement was created to create more residential property. Now, in when I referred to the reform in the late 2000s. City Council changed it, and in most of the sort of like high, more affluent areas of New York now, there is a set aside requirement that you have to build a certain amount of affordable units in these buildings. But one of the things that's interesting, and Capital New York published a really interesting story on this earlier this week that resonated with me from the research I did. You know, City Council is now doing deals with these developers to where they're making these affordability, quote unquote, affordable units sort of priced in the range for people who are making, you know, over six figures. You know, so basically they're subsidizing development, a quote unquote affordable development for people who, you know, by any reasonable measure are upper middle class or higher.
And that's another story, Jennifer. And I know that, I mean, we could get into this, but the de Blasio administration and the city council leadership believes that a lot of different categories of, you know, earners, income earners in New York are having trouble with housing other than the very wealthy. And so they want to create set-asides that create economic diversity in the city. You know, sometimes poor people have nowhere to go. The rich like to come, so we become a city of rich and poor, and it's the middle class that's fleeing perhaps more than others because they have just enough money to flee. But we need a middle class living in New York as well as working in New York. And, you know, you could argue that there's a real rationale for offering subsidies and incentives to create real economic diversity, including a strong middle class that can afford to live here. But that's another conversation. Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
I live in a rent-stabilized loft building in Lower Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
and starting about 4 or 5 years ago, an Iranian has started buying up the lofts from the rent-stabilized tenants, and he doesn't live there. He just kind of warehouses them, and by his own admission is like there 1 week a year, and so that's what's going on in my building.
One story from
Wow.
Lower Manhattan. Should we take her contact off the air if she's willing to give it? Are you following up?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of stories along these lines. I mean, Iranian. I'm sure she's referring to an Iranian American, but you know, there was.
Well, we don't know if she's referring to an Iranian American, right? I mean, your whole story is about people who live in other countries,
yeah.
who are sinking money into these condos and
mm-hmm.
other apartments in New York
yeah.
as investments, right? These aren't Russian Americans and.
Yeah.
you know, Italian-Americans and et cetera, who you're writing about in your article, they're Russians and they're Italians, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
Chinese,
I think,
Israelis,
I think what,
Arabs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, what I was going to say is that there's, with the Iranian issue, I mean, there's actually sort of, there's actually sanctions against Iran. And there was a story that just broke this week about how banks like Swiss banks helped the Iranian government to launder money through a Fifth Avenue office building.
Huh.
And this was actually part of our we looked into this as part of our story, and we worked with a group called the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists on this story, and they actually have a sort of companion piece that's coming out today in which they go into a lot of these cases in which actually sort of case studies of how money has been on occasion laundered through New York real estate, and that Iranian case is one of them.
And as we run out of time, we could just go through caller after caller after caller, all these people coming in with story after story. Caroline in Great Neck wanted to talk about a wave of Chinese money coming in and buying up a lot of the homes out there. Lucy in Brooklyn has a condo in Brooklyn, two all-cash foreign investors. Da, da, da. Eileen in Hoboken. This is happening in Hudson County, New Jersey as well, from an Australian investor. Michelle in Queens, is not just residential being inflated, also commercial where she is. So we see how many stories we could hear about this. Let me ask you one thing before you go. Is turnabout fair play in this respect? Because don't wealthy Americans buy up real estate and inflate the markets in country after country around the world? And isn't there a long history of this?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, and there's certainly a I mean, the United States is preaches free markets, you know, in every country around the world, and deregulation, and so it would be ironic indeed if we were to actually adopt regulations that discourage foreign investment in our own country.
Right. When we were almost the only rich country in the world, then it had to do with freedom.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there's a way. I mean, I think that there is a way to observe this phenomenon without being xenophobic or without sort of saying, you know, foreigners are horrible or rich people are horrible, and to just sort of say, okay, this is an interesting phenomenon, and it's something that is impacting the market and impacting prices. And yes, it has certain deleterious effects for individual apartment buyers, but from developers' perspectives, I mean, they're more than thrilled about this. It's driving a lot of development. It's creating jobs. It's creating construction jobs. I mean, all those people on 157 are drawing paychecks. And you know, there is very definitely a case to be made that this is a positive thing for New York's environment. But I think it's good to have this debate out in the open and not just sort of have these very sort of opaque kind of references to basically buildings that are being sold to, you know, these corporate entities that we have no idea who they are, or who our neighbors are, or who it is that's coming in and investing in the city. And I think, you know, we as New Yorkers have a right to kind of know who our neighbors are.
And pushing this debate out into the open in a long investigative piece, Take It to the Beach, alongside your James Patterson novel this week, and see which one you're drawn to if we ever get beach weather this weekend. Andrew Rice, editor at New York Magazine, this article in New York called The Stash Pad, about New York real estate as the new Swiss bank account. Thank you so much. Really, really fascinating.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a call in for this 3rd of July, with a Pew poll finding millennials much less patriotic than baby boomers. How is your patriotism different from your parents or your kids? 212-433-WNYC.